in every downturn, when there's been, let's call it agitation of my mental health and of my investors' investment safety, it's been because in every case, I can prove in every case, it's because we had a loan.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Joel Friedland has 40 years of experience as a broker, investor, and syndicator in industrial real estate. Joel, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Sam. It's great to see you.
Absolutely great to see you, Joel. I ask three questions to every guest who comes on the show. In 90 seconds or less, can you tell me where did you start, where are you now, and how did you get there?
Sure. So I'm 64 today. I've been in the real estate business since day one. I've only had one career, and it's industrial real estate in Chicago. I started out as a broker working for a family that was in the business for decades, and they had 80 buildings that they owned as syndicators. And they hired me as a leasing agent right out of college. And they trained me and taught me, and they were my mentors. And eventually, I tried to join the family. It wasn't my family, and they wouldn't let me in. So I started a business with three other guys, and we did the same thing. I've stayed close with that original family. I'm so close with them, actually, with one of the sons, that today I'm having a call with my advisory group. Before I buy buildings, I have an advisory group Zoom meeting, and he's one of the leaders of the Zoom call. And that's from 40 years ago. Same relationship, still love him. We love each other, and he's brilliant.
That's absolutely amazing. I mean, I don't know if I would put that in the blessed category. Like, there's very few people that can have a single career, not only a single career, but one in a very, very niche asset class without ever looking to the left or to the right. How did you stay on track and avoid temptation to look at other shiny objects?
So I have studied successful people. I've studied people who are super wealthy and primarily families that are super wealthy. And I'll tell you what they have done with their business. They've stuck with it. They don't go to the right. They don't go to the left. They just stuck with it. I can give you the stories of about 200 family businesses that I've done business with as a broker and as a syndicator where they invest with me. And every one of them goes back decades. I have a company, we're buying a building right now from a family that started a business in 1935 in Chicago. It's called, the company in the building is called Talkaphone. They make, you know, if you've ever been in a parking garage or a university or mass transit place where they've got those posts with the blue lights with the phone you pick up or you push a button to get security.
Yep. Yep.
They make those. Talkaphone makes that. So these two guys started the business back in the 1930s. And now the family that owns the building that they've been running the business in, they are the grandchildren of the original founder. Why are they so rich? Because they did one thing. Because if you jump around, you don't learn the ins and outs of the business. When you do something long enough, you learn it. And I'll give you an example, just like a metaphor or a, I don't know the difference between, an analogy. So my mother had kidney cancer diagnosed a few months ago. All right, so who does she go to? She goes to the kidney removal urologist who's the best in the world, right? You want the best one in the world. Would you go to someone who says, well, I used to do knees and I didn't like that so much. It didn't work out. So I started doing brain surgery. I didn't like that. So I decided to go into being a urologist, and I've done a few kidneys. I've done it for a couple of years. You know, you would move the frick out of there so fast.
Yes.
You want the person who has done dozens and dozens of kidney surgeries a month, right?
Right.
Same thing, same thing, same thing. So that's what my mother did. We're in Chicago. She went to the University of Chicago, and Dr. Shulhav is the guy that she saw. You know what? He removed my dad's kidney 12 years ago.
Wow.
He's the guy we trust. So I'm in the same business, industrial real estate in Chicago. The niche is small industrial buildings, Class B, with that are occupied by manufacturers that are owned by families. That's my niche. That's it. And there's 16,000 industrial buildings in Chicago, and there's about 20,000 companies in Chicago in industrial, 1.5 billion square feet. If I can't make a seven-figure income by knowing that market really well, I'm a moron. But I'll tell you what, if I go do deals in Tennessee, or I go into the office leasing business, or I go into the retail business or the multifamily, someone who's been in it for 40 years, like I have, is going to eat my lunch.
Right.
So I stick with one thing.
I love it. I love it. That is admirable. And I appreciate you giving the insight onto your motivation and kind of thought process behind why you have stuck with that one thing. That one thing has seen, I'm sure, in the last 40 years, many different comings and goings of both market swings, of industrial appetite, of tenant types, of lease rates, cap rates, the whole nine yards, if you will. Can you break down some of that for us? And maybe at the end of that, give us a state of the market today.
Sure. In 1981, when I started working for the Podolsky family, there were interest rates out there like you wouldn't believe,
Yeah.
17 to 20%. Makes
Yep, I
today's
remember that.
7% mortgage look like a really good deal. We were
Right.
in a terrible recession. It rode up after that because there's a recovery after recessions. And then in 1990, we hit another bump and there was a downturn. And through the 1990s, it was great. And then there was another downturn in 2001 when 9/11 happened. And we rode that up. And then there was another downturn, which was the worst one in 2008. And now things have been riding for 15 years, all to the good. Low interest rates, cap rates coming down. You can't blow it in a market where you can borrow at 4% and cap rates keep going down. But that's changed. And now people are struggling because interest rates are all of a sudden at 7% instead of at 4%. And if you had floating rate debt and a lot of debt, you're screwed. So the market's been great. Industrial's been great. For 4 years, rents have increased 80% throughout the entire market in North America, including Canada. And that means if your rent was $5 a square foot when you started out 5 years ago with a lease, today it's nine. So it's been booming because of the internet, because the internet requires warehouses, and because of manufacturing, because as manufacturing does well, it requires industrial buildings, which are warehouses that they fit with their machines and bring all their employees in to make stuff. So that's what the look is today. I think the market's coming down a little today. I think the real estate economy is in a bit of trouble. And industrial is still doing great, but it's not immune. Nothing's immune.
No, nothing's immune. Certainly, I would propose that things change, as in the especially, the types of industrial maybe that tenants want. Have you seen any shift in the last couple of years on the types of industrial real estate that people are leasing?
They're leasing every kind of industrial real estate. So if you drive down the highway in any town, big city, small town. Along the highway, you're going to see big industrial buildings occupied by companies like Amazon,
Right.
Wayfair, like Target for their online sales warehouse and for their warehouse for their stores. And if you think about it, every product in the world is made in an industrial building, except for crops that come from a farm, but they are brought to industrial to be packaged and sent out. So there's nothing, if you look around on your background and you've got the sign, you've got the wood, you've got the microphone, Everything in your office, in your house, was made in an industrial building someplace. And they have to keep making it. You know, you look in the background here, everything here, there's what's in my office here probably represents 10,000 industrial buildings where products were made that either are parts that went into my phone or parts that went into my lamp. Industrial is everywhere and it's necessary. And it's a part of the supply chain. It is the supply chain.
Right. No, that makes absolute sense. I love it. And it's one of those, I don't know if you'd call it recession proof, but it's almost. My question for you would be, is on the, how, as demand changes, or if demand doesn't change, I mean, tell me, I guess, on that front. I know you said that, yes, everything comes from a factory and or an industrial warehouse, but how do you position yourself to be in front of what that demand type is, and or what customers want? Does that question even make sense?
Yeah, I don't have to be in the front of it. I have to be in the middle of it.
What's that
I have
mean?
to be in the middle of it. I have to own industrial buildings in great locations where companies want to be. And I have to keep my tenants. And you and I talked about this before. We buy all of our buildings all cash, no mortgage, debt free. And I think I've done a little study. There's probably 4,000 syndicators in the United States with portfolios over $50 million. And I would say of the 4,000, we may be the only one that does all cash deals.
Yeah.
So when I say I have to be in the middle of it, I have to own buildings. My investors put $25, $50, or $100,000 into our deals. They expect me to know what I'm doing and to protect their money, which is why we don't have mortgages. You can't lose to a bank if there's no mortgage.
Right.
My tenants expect me to give them a fair deal, and they expect me to keep their roof from leaking. These are net leases, but even in a net lease, in industrial, landlords are almost always responsible for the roof and the structure of the building. So being in the middle of it means knowing my market inside out and only buying buildings that are desirable for any kind of tenant. No matter what they do, whether they're a distributor or a manufacturer, and making sure that they are in locations where there's a lot of population density, public transportation. In Chicago, we own 10 industrial buildings in the city. And with one exception, they are all occupied by distributors and manufacturers. We have one that's a service company. In Florida, for example, there's a complex in every major city in Florida where they have service companies and they have drive-in doors so that companies that install shower doors or companies that do sprinkler systems or clean pools, they don't have loading docks and they don't have manufacturing. Florida's not a manufacturing area.
Right.
So pretty much the Rust Belt is. So the Rust Belt is sort of the East Coast, the Midwest, and then going out into Southern California, there's a lot of manufacturers there, but most of the other markets are distribution markets. So to be ahead of the market, you'd have to have a big warehouse in Nashville. There aren't a whole lot of manufacturers moving to Nashville, and it's a smaller market. In Chicago, there are so many companies manufacturing products. I just need to own a building that they all like. That's the key. So it's got
Got
to
it.
have high ceilings. It's got to have good loading docks. It's all about the geometry and the physical makeup of the building. So I don't have to be in front of it because it's a very old line business. All these buildings go back to the 1960s, 70s, 80s, 90s, the last 20 years. We just buy existing buildings. We don't build anything. So the people who stay out in front of it are the developers who build these giant 500,000 square foot buildings, million square foot. We don't do that because we're syndicators. We have to do a smaller variety of business than buying a $200 million complex with one tenant.
Right. And that's actually here in the Memphis market, which is, a huge distribution market. That's what we're seeing sit vacant actually right now, are those massive buildings. that there was a boom there for a while, but those massive buildings are the ones that I was talking to a broker here locally about. They said the smaller stuff, like maybe, what you're getting into is stuff that's still, in high demand, but those huge buildings just are, they're tougher to move right now. So
Are
that's,
tough.
yeah, that's really interesting. Let me ask you this. Why do people sell these buildings? You're in a market that sounds like it has just, unmet demand. So why are people even selling this at all?
Now, they don't very often. That's the problem. There are very few buildings on the market. Our vacancy factor across the Chicago area is about 4%.
Whoa.
And people don't move. If you're in the industrial business, so let's say you're in multifamily, or let's say mobile home park, or let's say self-storage.
Yeah.
How long does it take one of those tenants to leave? A few hours, right? A few hours. An industrial company that's manufacturing products that has 40 machines that are screwed into the floor with 40 employees that have been trained how to use those machines over a period of years. Moving that takes 2 years to, from the
Right.
start when you think you want to move to actually implementing the move is a 2 year process.
Wow.
You can compress it probably to a year and a half if you're really good as a as an owner of a company. But why would they want to move if it takes 2 years to do it and it's a distraction from what they do running their business? Also, they can't lose their employees. They don't want to move. They don't want to retrain people. And also, usually, if it's an entrepreneurial-owned company, the location of their building is right near where they live so that they don't have to drive that far for their commute. So, for so many reasons, they don't leave. And you know, the cost of moving the machines, this is just one company. We have a company that makes fruit juice concentrates in a building in Chicago. They're in 40,000 square feet. If they moved, it would cost them $20 million.
Right. So they're heavily incentivized to stay put. That's
They're not
that.
leaving. Yeah.
No, they're
Yeah.
not going anywhere. I want to ask
Yeah.
you a question about your, and thanks for giving the insight on that. That's really cool to be in a market like that and to be able to play in that space is pretty cool. That's a very niche market, niche kind of type that you're in there in the industrial real estate space. So I think that's fascinating. But let's talk a little bit about your financing and or lack of financing model. When did you kind of hatch that idea and potentially tell us why?
I've bought 100 buildings over the years with my investor groups. And in every downturn, when there's been, let's call it agitation of my mental health and of my investors' investment safety,
Yeah.
it's been because in every case, I can prove in every case, it's because we had a loan.
Wow.
Every time you get in trouble, it's like, how are we going to pay the debt? How are we going to pay the mortgage? Okay, real estate is a mortgage business. It's a business where you have leverage. Everybody knows that that's what real estate is. But after 40 years, really after about 35 years, so a few years ago, after recovering from 2008, where we did have losses, we lost money on selling buildings that we should have made money on if we had better staying power. And I look at all of the deals of the 100 deals we've done, we own 19 and we've sold the other 81. And of the 81 we've sold, 9, which is roughly 10%, have lost money.
Wow.
And the common link on every loss is that when things got bad in a down market, paying the debt became very difficult. Banks have no sense of humor. And I've decided that rich people who invest in deals for the long term want safety first. They want to preserve their capital. And I have a group of them that hate losing money and like steady cash flow. You know what your cash flow is if you have no debt? It's 100% of your NOI. 100%. There's nothing going to the lender. There is no lender. So
Right.
an example, we have a building that's we're into it for about $2.5 million in Chicago. The company that's in it is a manufacturing company. They make welding safety products for the welding industry. The rent's $235,000 a year. We have some expenses, but they pay the taxes, insurance, maintenance, and utilities. When you take out our expenses, it's $220,000 of NOI on 2.7 million, which is our all-in price. It's an 8% cash on cash return. And we keep paying it because the tenant keeps staying. They've been in the building since, I think, 1987. They're not leaving. And the rent goes up every so often, sometimes every year in certain buildings. So the no debt concept for me is my investors love it. They do have riskier other investments. Like my typical investor might have 10, 20 syndication investments, private placements.
Sure.
We're the only one with no debt. I don't recommend that other people do this. I just do it because for me, it makes me feel safe. I sleep at night and my investors sleep at night, but it's not for everybody.
No, certainly not. I really like that model. I guess the one kind of standout question in my head is, how do you make competitive offers if you're doing it in all cash?
You mean offers to sellers?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, we're the most credible seller in town. We don't need a mortgage. We're all cash buyers. So if someone's trying to sell a building to us for $2 million, I say, I've got the cash in the bank. I don't need to borrow money. So we'll do our due diligence. We'll spend 30 days doing due diligence. If everything checks out, we'll close 2 weeks later. I don't need to go to a bank. I don't need to do anything. Just close.
Right. I guess the maybe the further thought on that is that leverage can potentially increase returns. So what you will have is that people can afford to pay more for it because they're taking leverage on that makes the deal, quote unquote, sweeter. Does that make any sense?
It does. And I consider that to be gambling.
Sure.
It's just, it is. It's gambling. And I'm not right. saying, listen, gambling, when you're an entrepreneur and you're in business or you're a real estate investor, you're a gambler to some extent, right? You can read, if you read the paper, it's Hines bought this building in Bedford Park, Illinois, and they made a bet on industrial in Bedford Park. It's a bet. It's a bet.
Right.
So every time you do a deal with a lot of leverage, if you're stretching to make the deal and you're trying to prove to your investors that you're going to get them a better return than anyone, and to do so, you need to take a lot of risk by borrowing a lot of money where rates have to stay low, tenants can't leave, the property doesn't need a lot of work. It doesn't need a new heating system. It doesn't need the driveway redone. It doesn't need roofs redone. If you can find the perfect situation and the market's going up, yeah, sure. You can overpay for everything.
Sure.
We don't overpay for anything.
Right.
Right. If someone wants to pay more than us because they're bigger gamblers than we are, we just don't get the deal.
Right. I love it. I love the discipline there. And I really actually appreciate that, because I mean you know what you want. One, the price of what it takes to sleep at night. There is a price to that, and that is maybe that you have less or you know lower returns maybe than what the next guy does that takes on leverage. But that is a price you're willing to pay, and I love that. I mean, and yeah. It sounds like your investors love that too, because again, like you own it in cash. Like okay, so oh well, like.
Right. We're risk averse. That's the term. We're risk averse. And today, for example, I'm seeing a lot of people getting in trouble because they had floating rate debt and they,
oh gosh,
if you're the kind of gambler in real estate that says, I'm going to make a bet. I'm going to bet that if I buy this $10 million complex and I put $7 million of debt on it, so I have $3 million of equity. And I'm buying it for a 6 cap. If everything goes perfect, in 3 years, I might be able to sell it for a 5 cap. But what happens if the market's bad, rates have gone up, you can't afford your mortgage to even get to the point of selling it, the roof needs to be redone, the parking lot needs to be patched, and now you're in a situation where you're like swallowing hard and like, you know that feeling. I've over the years been a casino gambler. You know that dopamine hit you get when you're playing blackjack? Do you gamble at all?
I don't want to say this on air. 20 years ago, in my early 20s, I did. I gave that up about 20 years ago. But yeah, in my earlier life, when I was younger and had more money to blow and no family and kids, yes, I did at one point.
Okay, so I believe that a $10 million purchase with a $7 million mortgage is a form of gambling.
Oh,
Not that
absolutely.
it's not that it's wrong. And if you can project a 20% IRR over a 3-year period and make it happen, that means you bought it for 10 million. It has to be sold for more than 10 million because you got to get your money back and you got to pay the mortgage off. So you've got to get more than 10 million or you lose. So
Right.
you're betting that the property in the next 3 years or 5 years will be worth, because you have selling costs, it's got to be worth 11 million just to break even.
At least.
So you're betting that what you're buying now for 10 million will be worth at least 12 million, or you're a loser in the
Right.
casino.
Right.
And if anything goes wrong, your staying power to get to that fifth year is debatable. And that's why you're seeing so many foreclosures today and so many people selling buildings for a loss all over the place. We just don't want to do that.
No, there's no, and that's it. That's it, man. I love your approach. Love the way you guys are doing things. I love the no debt syndication. That's really, really cool. So thank you for
But
taking
it's
the
not
time
for
today.
everybody. I'm not recommending it. People who go into syndications like mine, I recommend to them that they go into some risky things with a lot of upside.
Sure.
Because you got to have a balanced portfolio. First of all, they should own some stocks, they should own some bonds, they should have some cash, and they should have some real estate or other alternative investments. I'm just a little tiny piece of everybody's portfolio.
Right.
Just a tiny piece. And that's all I should be.
Right. Right. Yeah, but it's an important piece. It's an important piece, and it's a risk. I'm not gonna call it risk-free, but it's almost as risk-free of an investment as you can get. So
Yeah,
that's
I call it highly risk mitigated
right. Highly risk
investment.
mitigated. Yeah, absolutely. Joel, thank you for taking the time to come on the show today. It was certainly insightful. I've learned a lot about your market. I've learned a lot about your work history and career experience. It was certainly great to have you on. And again, I learned a lot from you. Love the way you guys are doing all of your deals in all cash, no debt. That's very, very compelling. If our listeners want to get in touch with you and learn more about you, what is the best way to do that?
Brit Properties, BRIT with one T, BritProperties.com.
BritProperties.com. We'll make sure we include that there in the show notes. Thank you so much again for coming on today. I certainly enjoyed it.
Thank you, Sam.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.